This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave.
Hey, a big thank you to the brand new Tuesday Drive team there, Alex, Adam, and Arvi the Button Monkey, I think it was mentioned in the studio. Is that offensive? I don't know. And also Mark there for the news. Great to have new neighbours there. This is World Wide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show. We take you around the globe one country at a time. Tonight in the studio, we've got Dean.
G'day, Matt.
Hello, Paul.
Hello.
And I am indeed Matt. In Australia today, gay marriage is the hot issue for LGBT people. But in many countries, for gay people, just to survive their daily lives is their biggest focus. While the right to life is a term that's synonymous with the abortion debate, what happens when you apply that concept to LGBT people? So rather than looking at a specific country tonight, we are looking at how this most basic of human rights is being violated around the world in different ways.
So for countries with the death penalty for being gay, by what means do they try to fit this with crimes defined as most serious, like murder and aggravated rape?
How does the deprivation of basic human rights, such as ignoring violence against gays or failing to investigate killings, fit within the concept of a person's right to life?
And is a new approach needed by the international community to ensure gay people can just live? To dig deep into a different way of looking at the right to life, tonight we speak with Dr. Paula Gerber from Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation. Kaleidoscope Australia has just made a submission on the right to life for LGBT people to the United Nations Human Rights Committee.
We would love you to be part of the show. You can simply send us an SMS, 0427JOY949, or send us an email which comes straight into the studio, onair@joy.org.au. And don't forget, we're also on Facebook.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities, from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
So in Hong Kong this week, or on Sunday, about 15,500 people gathered in Tamar Park to celebrate LGBTI Pride at Pink Dot Hong Kong.
Go Hong Kong.
I know, it's amazing. Now, it's one of the largest displays of LGBTI Pride in the Asian region. So that was an increase in the numbers from the previous year, which was 12,000. So that's quite a big jump.
So Pink Dot's become a bit of a phenomenon throughout Asia. It started in Singapore, and that's still going strong 7 years on. It's moved on to Japan. Japan, Malaysia, and now Taiwan.
Where do I get my pink dot from?
Well, actually, you don't get one. You take along a pink torch or a torch with a pink light on it. And then as the sun goes down, they take these fantastic shots of glowing pink auras across the city, and it looks fantastic.
Do we have pictures of this on our Facebook page?
We do, and we've also posted a link to a site that has video clips as well. It looks lovely. So this year's Pink Dot Hong Kong was organised by the Big Love Alliance and the Pink Alliance with the support of the progressive religious coalition Covenant of the Rainbow.
Sorry, a religious coalition?
Yeah, they do actually have a progressive religious organisation, or one at least, in Hong Kong. So it's free, it's fun, it's a carnival for allies, families, friends, and colleagues of LGBTI people, so it's very inclusive, and it's basically advocating diversity and love and equality. And
I think the reason why this is such a significant one is that Hong Kong's been a bit of a laggard when it comes to LGBT rights.
Yeah, that's putting it politely. Homosexuality was finally legalised in 1991, and the age of consent was equalised for gay couples in 2006. Now, in 2008, a judge upheld a ruling against RTHK, which is a radio station, TV station, for broadcasting a program about homosexuality which failed to give airtime to homophobic counter viewpoints. Thanks a lot. And until as recently as 2009, cohabiting gay couples were not recognised in the Domestic Violence Ordinance. Now, there's more than that. Anti-discrimination laws remain very flimsy for gay people, and same-sex marriage and civil unions are illegal. So there are still no specific laws targeting hate crimes directed against the gay community.
But we are happy to see a pink glow on the horizon for them. Across to France now, where HIV is in the news. In fact, it's in the news around the world. HIV self-testing kits are now available in France for the first time. And these are sort of akin to a pregnancy testing kit. So there's a small pin, I guess you call it, that to
so
do a little blood test.
Something.
You don't have to pee on anything,
it's a,
no.
A little lancet. Little
lancet,
called.
There you go. A little blood test, which allows you, within about 15 minutes, to have, if you like, a preliminary assessment of your HIV status. And the user basically activates the test, waits, and then they, if it comes up as positive, they still go in and get a full test to make sure. Now, Australia, on the other hand, is in the news, but for entirely different reasons.
Yes. So
perhaps
unlike,
for being quite backwards.
Yes, in a way. I mean, France, admittedly, France is only the third country to permit self-testing for HIV. The issue being they're concerned about people not getting adequate follow-up if they take the test and it comes back with a positive result. But as you probably hear some of our other colleagues on radio, such as Dean Beck on Word for Word, often talking about, we are way, way behind when it comes to PrEP.
This is in the issue of PrEP, which is a prevention program. So by taking a tablet a day of a drug called Truvada, it drastically reduced, in fact, some studies around the world have shown no new HIV transmissions.
And we probably should warn our listeners, there may be some strong language following.
Language alert. Indeed, you may have actually seen this language around town. So some very large rock posters have been put up with the very large letters saying, you can fuck raw, and PrEP works, no more HIV. Organisers of this campaign, which is a quite a controversial but grassroots campaign, in fact, many of the, I guess, more organised groups, PLWHA and Victorian AIDS Council, didn't know who put these out at first. They were going, ooh, who said that? The organisers have come out and said that the campaign, the current poster campaign, is designed to shock. So, in other words, they're quite frustrated with the process that Australia has not moved forward on PrEP. We're still in this trial stage when other countries have had it for several years.
You can buy it from overseas if you'd want to, but it's about $1,000 a month for a supply.
Yes, well.
Yeah. So $12,000 a year is exorbitant, so not something that most of us are going to be running out to pick up, I think.
Now, if you've got thoughts on whether PrEP is good or bad and what your opinions are, send us a message. It's 0427JOY949 and or you can email us onair@joy.org.au.
And we did get a message on our Facebook page as well about PrEP, saying that it's an effective tool against HIV, but there are other STDs that it doesn't work against, so there needs to be an effective education campaign about its limitations. Thank you, Maurizio.
Some good news. Same-sex marriage is back on in Ireland.
Was it off?
Well, apparently it was, because there was an a legal case that was putting it to question. The original plan was to enact the law by the end of July, but this was delayed by two men that sought to challenge the outcome of the referendum that they held in May.
And Paul, who were these two experts?
One was an electrician and the other one was a gardener.
They're
entitled to their view, but the Supreme Court didn't
well
say-
actually the Supreme Court said they weren't really.
Oh well good.
They were trying to claim that the state's use of resources was unconstitutional
because it promoted a particular outcome in relation to same-sex marriage and the referendum.
Yes.
There you go. Now, moving on to Serbia, about 300 gay rights supporters marched through Belgrade from the government building to the Serbian parliament on Sunday, and riot police closed off the city centre to ensure the safety of the Pride parade because it's been attacked repeatedly by right-wingers in previous years. For example, 2010, they had thousands of thugs show up and sort of attack the poor people who were trying to march.
Instead, Serbia, this year they had thousands of police.
Well, pretty much, because even though only 300 people marched, including one Australian, actually, we had the Australian ambassador to Serbia and Macedonia, Julie Feeney. She marched in the Pride Parade.
Good on you, Jules.
That's it. Good on you, Australian influence there.
Wave that flag.
Yeah, that's it. Look, it's very important. Serbia wants to become part of the EU and the European Union, and they did what they could to actually stop.
Now, news in brief in the United Kingdom. The future King William V, Prince William, has taken part in a session on bullying and homophobia in schools, in which he specifically spoke out against homophobia for the first time.
Kenya has hosted its inaugural LGBT film festival in Nairobi.
The first children's book targeting the children of same-sex parents has been published in Peru.
And in the USA, limited edition Doritos Rainbows have been released, a limited edition version of the Cool Ranch flavour chips baked in the colours of the rainbow to represent the pride flag.
And that's a wrap.
That's your Worldwide Wrap. Keep up with LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like us on Facebook, Worldwide Wave, or visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
More of this podcast soon. Coming up, we'll tell you how you can claim a free audiobook from Joy sponsor Audible. The volunteers of our program production team thank you for listening to our podcast service. Your support is everything to us.
And absolutely everybody is tuned in right here to Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
And that was Vanessa Amorosi with As absolutely everybody.
Anyone listening to Joy would have no idea. I'm old enough and have been with Joy long enough to remember the late 90s when they sent a communique around saying, please stop playing it. And there was actually a poster on the wall of the studio. Basically, it was played so often that subscribers and our dear listeners were complaining.
But see, now it's retro, it's back in fashion.
Totally. More royalties for Vanessa.
Well, the excuse I can give is because of the heavy subject that we're going to be talking with to Paula about, that we needed some uplifting music.
That's right.
To
that
keep
was
us
the brief.
In a good mood.
Up and bright.
Certainly fits the bill.
And we have been joined in the studio by Dr. Paula Gerber from Kaleidoscope Australia. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you. Great to be back here, guys.
A great friend of our show here. Now, the right to life. We want to talk to you about this in the recent report you've put into the United Nations Human Rights Committee, because the right for life is pretty much owned by the abortion lobby. But you've sort of taken this into the LGBT realm and included it in a submission to the United Nations. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I think the co-opting of the term right to life by the anti-abortion lobby group has really restricted the meaning of that term unduly. And in fact, it is, in human rights law, it's a recognised fundamental human rights that no state can violate, and that is the right to human life. And this can be breached in a number of ways, including obviously the death penalty. But so we wanted to reclaim that space and to bring to the attention of the UN Human Rights Committee how the right to life is being violated against LGBTI people around the world. Because this committee in particular, and the UN is made up of lots of different committees, but this particular committee has a very poor track record when it comes to addressing LGBTI rights in their what's called general comments, which are their publications saying this is how we interpret international human rights law. And they've done this, they've had 35 general comments, and only the most recent one, comment number 35, made any reference to LGBTI, to sexual orientation, to gender identity. So we thought it's time to give them a little nudge and get them thinking a bit more broadly.
Is it accepted? I mean, this is to me, this sounds like something new, but is it accepted at a UN level that this is that LGBT issues can be interpreted in this way?
In a still, I think, too narrow way. So they would all accept that imposing the death penalty for homosexuality breaches the right to life, but they probably haven't turned their mind to all the other things that happen that do breach the right to life as well.
So we'll sort of delve into all those things tonight, but let's kick off with the death penalty, because it is, I guess, the most visible, the one that somebody could least argue against. It's a fair dinkum breach of your right to living, isn't it?
It's a bit of a no-brainer, yes.
So in the legal sense, the UN is on board with that?
They absolutely are. So there are 77 countries around the world that still criminalise homosexuality. Five of those unequivocally impose a death penalty for that offence. And what the UN has said in the past is that the death penalty is a breach of the right to life, but if you are going to have it, then you must only have it for the most heinous of crimes, and generally that's murder, maybe aggravated rape. But to have the death penalty imposed for a crime where there is no victim and nobody's been harmed, the UN has said unequivocally no, that is a clear breach of the right to life.
Is that, how do these countries explain that away then? If they're not changing their laws, how do they say, well, no, we think it is?
That is the beauty of international human rights law, because it is very different.
I'm not
from...
sure that it's beautiful in this case.
No, I was being a tad sarcastic. Because in domestic law, in Australian law, if you breach the law, then you can go to jail and you can be put on probation and you can be fined and all sorts of things can happen to you. If you break international human rights law, there's no international jail that people can be sent to. There's no prosecutions that can happen. The way international human rights law works is in a very diplomatic way, and essentially the only thing that they can do is what's called naming and shaming.
Okay.
So we will try and embarrass you and humiliate you on the international stage by exposing the fact that you are breaching international human rights law. The problem is, you know, every country in the world breaches international human rights law.
Whoops.
I mean, Australia does. So a lot of countries are loath to criticise other countries because they don't want the magnifying glass and looked at on them.
Well, you do it too.
Exactly. And I must say...
Well, that has happened with Australia and Indigenous, the way we look after Indigenous communities.
Precisely.
Well.
I went to teach international human rights law in Kosovo not long after the NATO bombing ended in 2000, I think it was. And the first thing the class said to me is, what is Australia doing with your Aboriginal people, and how can you come here and teach us about international human rights law when you are treating your Indigenous people so appallingly?
And you were like, oh my goodness, is that the time? Bus go.
So which are these, which are the five countries that you, are they their usual suspects that we hear about
which
so often?
Which countries shouldn't we be visiting?
You know, look, Saudi Arabia,
yep.
Iran, Mauritania, parts of Iraq where ISIS controls, and there are some countries where it's just parts of. So Somalia, Nigeria, Afghanistan. It's not across the whole board, but there are certainly parts of it. Yemen is another one. So you basically steer clear of the Middle East and Africa, and you might be all right.
For those ISIS-controlled ones, where it's basic. Summary execution in many cases, not even necessarily law, it just sort of happens. If those people weren't gay, would it be making as much of an issue worldwide? The crimes that they're doing are horrific, but is it ISIS is known for trying to get media publicity? Is this just a part of that getting publicity?
So Erica Betts recently said that the crimes that ISIS is committing against Christians are the worst in the world. And the one thing I try to avoid is comparing human rights violations. What's worse? I mean, the way ISIS are treating women and children and people of different religions Muslims who don't belong to their particular sect is horrendous. So, you know, there are so many atrocities being committed by ISIS that you don't know where to begin. But certainly, you know, throwing gay men off the building is something that is going to grab worldwide media attention, because it is just so abhorrent to see that sort of imagery.
And even worse, they tweeted "Love wins" when they did it after the change to the law in the United States a couple of months ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Worldwide Wave. We're speaking with Dr. Paula Gerber about the right to life in the LGBT context. You're on Joy 94.9.
We know you love listening to Joy, and this podcast is thanks to Joy sponsor Audible. Keep listening to hear our exclusive Joy offer. audible.com.au/joy.
This is Audrey Gochran, the director of Amnesty International's Africa program on the World Wide Wave.
And this is World Wide Wave, and that was Jess Glanwood. Don't be so hard on yourself.
I'll try not to be. We are joined in the studio by Dr. Paula Gerber from Kaleidoscope Australia, and we're talking about the right to life in the LGBT context. You mentioned, Paula, the 77 countries there that criminalise homosexuality. If a country criminalises homosexuality but doesn't actually enforce it, which seems to happen in a number of countries, is that as bad? Is that any better?
It's actually not, because the effect of having homosexuality as a criminal offence, even if it's not enforced, even if no one's prosecuted, is the effect it has on society as a whole. It says these people are criminal and you are entitled to treat them differently. You are entitled to discriminate against them because, you know, basically at any time we could arrest them and prosecute them. So it's the message that it sends to society. It's the same argument I say in Australia about not allowing same-sex couples to marry. It sends a message to the rest of society, we're going to treat these couples and these families different, so you can as well. It sort of legitimises discrimination.
These 77 countries, so what we're talking about here is criminalising consensual sexual behaviour between consenting adults. So everybody's on the same page and happy about it, except the law says no. Now, a great number of these countries, you point out in your report, are signed up to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So they've signed up saying they've got a level of human rights that they're signing up for. Does this covenant make any difference then?
It does, surprisingly, that it people are brought to account if they haven't ratified this human rights covenant. It is considered to be the bedrock of international human rights law. And so it does have a very large number of ratifications. So if we take the Convention on the Rights of the Child as sort of the benchmark, that's got 193 state parties. So 193 countries of the world have all signed up to protect the kiddies. That's a bit of a no-brainer. But when you come to civil and political rights, it drops down to, last time I looked, I think it was about 163. So still the vast majorities of countries around the world have signed on to this covenant because they don't want to have other countries saying, you know, what's wrong with you that you're not prepared to agree to abide by these basic minimum standards. And so a lot of countries, you know, the first thing they do when they are formed, East Timor, South Sudan, they started ratifying these treaties because it's part of being a recognised
country.
Yeah, Taiwan would love to ratify these treaties, as would Palestine, because only states can ratify these human rights instruments. So there is a sort of a kudos as well in signing up.
Other than these laws, what else is there something that the 77 countries have in common?
There are a couple of factors that we can point to that they share in common, and one of them is that well over half of these countries are members of the Commonwealth. So we can thank the British Empire for spreading, generally it was Section 377 of the Penal Code, wherever they went.
We were very good at imposing that.
We're blaming you, Paul.
I'm sorry on behalf of my nation.
So there are 52 members of the Commonwealth, and I think 43 of them still criminalise homosexuality. So that's one common feature. The other would be religion. I mean, those countries that aren't part of the Commonwealth tend to be countries that are very religious. A lot of them are Islamic countries. So they tend to be the two common factors. And then there are some nuances. Some of them only criminalise same-sex sexual conduct between men. Others go, we're going to capture the women as well. And that's, you can't blame the Commonwealth for that because, of course, Queen Victoria didn't believe in lesbians.
There were no lesbians.
But countries like Sri Lanka in 1995 said, well, it's discrimination if we're only going to prosecute gay men. We should prosecute gay women as well. So
does the Commonwealth have, given that it is the basis of it is England, and England's been fairly progressive most recently in their LGBT rights, does the Commonwealth have a role in generating change within their realm?
Absolutely. So the Commonwealth has the CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting every 2 years, and I went to the one 2 years ago in Sri Lanka, which was a very interesting experience because it's obviously a very hostile country to LGBTI people. And this year it's in Malta in November, so a much more hospitable country for LGBTI people. But it is a very difficult path to go down. You've got to really tread that fine line because the last thing you want is to be accused of being neo-colonialist, because the countries that have decriminalised who are part of the Commonwealth are Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK. So they're all the sort of the white Anglo countries. If we're seen as pointing the finger now at the African and Asian countries saying you must do this, it doesn't get a good reception. So I think it's a delicate issue that has to be handled very sensitively, and you have to get on board countries that are part of the Commonwealth, those 12 countries that have decriminalised or have never had it as a criminal offence, and get dialogue happening between like-minded countries from similar regions.
You've got a supporter in that. We've had a message in on Facebook. That's W3Joy on Facebook from Sally saying, right to choose, full stop. Thanks, Sally. Now, tell us about India. India is an interesting one because they've decriminalised and then recriminalised homosexuality. How did their courts view the right to life?
So, essentially, there are two ways that you can achieve decriminalisation. One is through Parliament and the other is through the courts. Now, when you do it through Parliament, it's pretty much done, full stop. It's not going to be looked at again, one would hope. But when a court do it, there are avenues of appeal. And so it was a one level of court that said this is a breach of the right to life and breach of human rights, and it's unconstitutional and we are going to rule it as an invalid law. But 4 years later, the appeal was finally heard and they overturned that decision. So there were just 4 years of LGBTI people not being treated as criminals, and then it was reintroduced. So it was almost worse than if it had never been decriminalised at all. So I think the better pathway to reform has to be by going through Parliament rather than the courts, because I think you don't have that avenue of appealing it down the track.
Something similar to the same-sex marriage debate in Australia, perhaps.
Indeed.
Now, one of the issues in terms of right for life that you look at too is where countries do not investigate crimes against LGBT people, or there is a reluctance of a country to prevent violence against LGBT people. Explain to us how that becomes a challenge to the right for life.
So when you think about the right to life in that broader, holistic way, you realise that it's not just about gay people being executed, but death happens in a number of ways. And one of the things that is apparent in the LGBTI community around the world is that we have a higher rate of suicide than almost any other population. And that comes about because there is prejudice and persecution and discrimination on a daily basis against people, and it just becomes too hard. So if you are being beaten up by thugs on the street in Kazakhstan or in Russia and you can't go to the police because you know that they're not going to do anything about it because they probably have the same view as the thugs who beat you up.
Well, they might actually be the thugs that beat you up.
Indeed. Indeed. So you become that you can't leave your home for fear of the hate that you are going to be subjected to for just being yourself out on the streets. In other situations, though, the persecution comes from within the family, and this is much more common with lesbians and with gay men. Is that it is their fathers and their brothers that will often put out an honour killing on them because they've shamed the family because they are gay. So the harm that can be inflicted on gay people comes from, and trans people, a variety of different avenues. It's not always the state, but the state does have an obligation to regulate so that the LGBTI people aren't harmed. So if police are refusing to prosecute or refusing to investigate killings, then it is up to the state to take action in order to meet their international human rights obligations and investigate the police and say, you've got to do your job.
We are lucky enough here to be in a country that has lots of support for people who might have issues around suicide. You can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard on 1800 18 4527. You're on Worldwide Wave.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
We are looking tonight at the right for life with Dr. Paula Gerber from Kaleidoscope Australia. Paula, let's talk about other forms of discrimination which might impact people's right for life, particularly around access to HIV/AIDS treatments.
Yes. Well, this flows on from the discussion we were having earlier about criminalisation of homosexuality, because researchers found that when homosexuality is criminalised, then people don't feel comfortable going to seek medical treatment for HIV, for example. So we have a country like Papua New Guinea, which has one of the highest HIV rates in the world. And that is because it is a criminal offence there, and it forces people to go underground. And when you're put into that situation, you tend to engage in more risky behaviour. And the result is very, very high rates of AIDS. So Dame Carol Kudu, a former politician, very well-respected politician in Papua New Guinea, brought a bill before Parliament to try and decriminalise homosexuality, not on the basis that it was a violation of the right to life or human rights, but on the basis of health, that if we actually want to get on top of this AIDS epidemic, then one of the best things that we can do is to decriminalise homosexual behaviour.
But the bill didn't get up?
It did not get up. And again, you've got a country that's both Commonwealth and very Christian. And that combination tends to be lethal for respecting LGBTI rights, pun intended.
There are a lot of countries around the world where that has worked, though, where HIV has been, if you like, a lead-in to LGBT rights, because it is just such a big health issue and it extends beyond the LGBT community.
Exactly. So often we certainly, Kaleidoscope and other LGBTI organisations, don't have a one-size-fits-all approach to improving respect for human rights of LGBTI people. If it's better to go down the path of health, then that's the path we'll go down. Education is another one where, you know, you can find good entry points into getting greater respect for human rights, because everyone does recognise the right to education. And so if you can highlight that LGBTI youth are dropping out of school at high numbers because of the bullying and the abuse that they're being subjected to, sometimes you can get a bit of an audience with the powers that be using that argument.
What about trans people? What sort of right to life issues might they experience?
An enormous number. One of the sort of the cases that we highlighted in our report is their inability to access medical treatment. So you immediately think, oh, in terms of transitioning, and that's an issue in Australia where it's not covered by Medicare to get medical procedures to transition. But it's actually also health issues that don't even relate to transition. So we highlighted a couple of stories of trans men who had developed ovarian cancer and uterine cancer and could not get treatment. They went to 20, one trans man went to 20 doctors and couldn't get anyone to treat him, because the doctor thought it was going to damage their medical practice if it was known that they were treating a trans person. And then
isn't there any Hippocratic Oath that says
what
you
about
must
the right to privacy? It's not like the what do they have, like glass windows, and everyone gets examined in front of a baying crowd?
Well, that's another human right that is often violated. And in the case of uterine cancer in the trans man, the insurance company wouldn't cover the treatment because they said our policies don't cover uterine cancer in men.
Oh, that's a way of inverting the right to change one's gender and then using it to their advantage, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly.
There must be some good news stories out there. Please tell us there's some good news stories.
There are, I'm very pleased to say, some wonderful good news stories. So, very interestingly, the most recent country to decriminalise homosexuality was Mozambique.
Yay, and we spoke to them just before this happened, so we're really pleased that it's happened.
And they went down an interesting pathway, and it's the same pathway that I think the Cook Islands is about to follow, and that is, instead of making a big song and dance and repealing the sections relating to sodomy in the criminal law, they did an overall review of their criminal code and developed a completely new criminal law act. And the offences relating to sodomy simply weren't there. So it wasn't a big song and dance. It's just, here's our new criminal code. We've modernised it, and offences against the order of nature and sodomy and all of that I've quietly slipped away.
Taken away all those 300-year laws from Britain.
Yes.
Click delete.
See, now that would work, I reckon. Yeah, click delete.
And we can look to Asia for some really good developments in the trans area. So Thailand has just passed the Gender Equality Act. Nepal has a new constitution that protects trans and third genders. So there are good news stories out there. Unfortunately, they don't get the media attention that they should. And we really need to do that, because one of the things that has also come out when we're looking at the mental health of LGBTI people is when all they see in the media is the hate and the slander and the bad news stories, then that affects their mental health. Whereas if you've got the stories out there about the good news stories, about improvements that are being made in the laws to respect LGBTI community, then that has a positive effect.
Is the international community doing enough? And I guess in submitting this to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, what are you hoping to achieve? What do you think the outcome will be?
The outcome will hopefully be General Comment 36 that will talk about the right to life, and in very explicit, unequivocal terms, the Human Rights Committee will take up many of the recommendations we've got out here in our submission about broadening the understanding of the right to life and highlighting all of these issues that the LGBTI community face that do impinge upon their right to life. Internationally, and including in Australia, I would like to see a greater focus on LGBTI rights beyond marriage equality. I'm all for marriage equality, but I get frustrated that it is hijacking all the
oxygen
for LGBTI rights. And when we do have these, you know, extreme human rights abuses taking place, including in our near neighbours in Manus Island, in Nauru with asylum seekers, if just, you know, 25% of the attention that is paid to marriage equality was paid to these other issues, I think it would be really helpful.
The report is fascinating reading, and congratulations to Kaleidoscope for looking at this in a different light and bringing it to the attention of the world. Is it on your website?
It is on our website, and if I can perhaps flag another new document that will be going up there later this year, is going to be launched by Michael Kirby, our patron, in December in Sydney, and that is a guide to using another human rights instrument, the International Covenant on Economics and Social and Cultural Rights. So really, instead of let's just focus on death penalty and criminalisation, we can make a huge improvement in the day-to-day lived experience of LGBTI people around the world if we use the human rights to health, to education, to housing, to family, all of those ones, then we can use that treaty far more effectively. I think it's a really underutilised tool, so stay tuned for that one.
We would love to have you or Michael Kirby on the show to dissect that. That'd be fantastic. You're on World Wide Wave.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
This is Eve from Cameroon on Joy 94.9.
A huge thank you to Dr. Paula Kerber from Kaleidoscope Human Rights Foundation. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you for having me.
Your website is
www.kaleidoscopeaustralia.com.
And thank you to Facebook messages from Mel, Lily, Tanuj, Maurice, Doug, Jane, and a heap more.
And Maurizio, who sent one too.
That's right, our W3 Joy on Facebook.
Next week, we're off to the UK. We're looking at being gay at work, and we're speaking to a global LGBT recruitment hub. Stick around. Coming up next, Around the World in 80 Gays with Anne Louise. They're off to China.
And then followed by Transpositions at 9 p.m, Sci-Fi and Squeam at 10, and Stripped Down with Jonathan Brown at 11 p.m. And what song are we going
music?
Out, what song are we going out with tonight,
something,
Paul?
Something quite apt, I think. It's All the World Needs Is Love.
Oh, bless.
Oh, groove hug. Catch you next week.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love.
Thanks for tuning in to yet another Joy podcast sponsored by Audible. You can support Joy by signing up to a free 30-day Audible trial. Get your very own free audiobook now. audible.com.au/joy.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.